Well, we're so glad you've chosen GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing information source. Today's special guest, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University and author of The Inform Act. My featured guest today says economic calamity is inevitable. It's just a matter of when the entire edifice implodes. Author of The Clash of the Generations, Get What's Yours, The Secrets to Maximizing Social Security, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff of Boston University joins us. He's also the author of The Inform Act, which we've talked about here on the show. Welcome back, Professor Kotlikoff.
Great to be back with you.
You know, Professor, you've brought up this in the past. I think it's really worth repeating here, that the United States may be in worse financial shape than even Detroit, which, of course, went bankrupt.
Okay, well, what we've done is Enron-type accounting at the federal level for decades. What we've kept our obligations, most of our obligations, IOUs, that Uncle Sam has issued off the books. So, to make this clear, if I go to Uncle Sam comes to you today and takes $10,000 in taxes, in money, takes $10,000 from you and then promises to pay you back $50,000 in 30 years, and if he calls what he takes from that $10,000 that he takes from you taxes, and he calls the $50,000 in the future a transfer payment, then that obligation to pay you the $50,000 doesn't show up on the books. And on the other hand, if he takes the $10,000 and calls that $10,000 he takes from you borrowing and says that the $50,000 or some portion of it is return of principal plus interest, then whatever he says he owes you in the future on that borrowing is going to be included in the book, on the books. It will be entered as part of official debt. So we're keeping almost all our liabilities off the books. About 80% of our liabilities are off the books. Our official debt's about $20 trillion. Our true debt is about $200 trillion. That's what we call the fiscal gap, which is the difference in present value between all the projected future spending and all the projected future taxes. So the net present value fiscal gap is about $200 trillion large. That's 10 times larger than the official debt.
Estimates of long-term debt range wildly, and you've put numbers out there in excess of $200 trillion. I mean, this is a startling number. I'm sure it's far exceeds the global GDP. Very few people can wrap their minds around to think in terms of millions, let alone trillions. What are the implications of $200 trillion?
Okay, we're talking about 10% of GDP, about a tenth of our output every year. We would have to set aside to pay off this fiscal gap every year. So if we took 10% of GDP for the rest of time, the present value of that would come up to about $200 trillion. So another way of putting this is that we either need to raise taxes by about 53%, every single federal tax, and that would produce about 10% of GDP in revenue, or we could cut every single government expenditure, defense, my mom's Social Security checks, all the payments for Medicare, cut all that stuff by about 33%, and we'd also come up with a save 10% of GDP every year, and that also would balance the book. So you can see that this is a tremendously difficult thing to deal with, because we're so far into the red. Now, we knew that the baby boomers were going to retire. We knew for decades that things were going to hit the fan when that happened. And every year we just got closer and closer to having to make these transfer payments, which were not put on the books. So we ignored them. And so this is the malfeasance that both parties have engaged in for decades. Interestingly, there is one person at the White House who seems to understand the magnitude of our indebtedness, and that's Steve Bannon. Not that I'm a fan of Steve Bannon's association with Breitbart and some of his unusual opinions about things. He does. He has mentioned this fiscal gap in public over the years. So that's, I find that kind of curious. But in the main, the Republicans and the Democrats don't want to hear about this because they don't want to reveal the kind of hot water they put our children in. It's highly unethical. Both President Washington and President Jefferson admonished the country not to leave our debts on, you know, for our children to pay. And we've done it through this kind of, you know, pay, take as you go, take money, call it taxes from young people, give it to ourselves, older people, we spend it, and then we promise our kids that when they're old, they'll get repaid in the form of transfer payments, and then they become old and they have to look to their kids to rip off their kids. It's not what you do when you're an adult running a country, but that's exactly what six decades of political machinations have produced. So, yeah, it's a terrible situation. We have in the Inform Act, if you go to theinformact.org, theinformact.org, there's a bill that I helped write that was endorsed by eight senators, one of whom is Tim Kaine, the Democratic vice presidential nominee, and Senator Thorne. Those are the two co-sponsors. Thorne is a Republican from, I believe, North or South Dakota, one of the Dakotas. Tim is a senator from Virginia, Tim Kaine. So we have some responsible people in the Senate, but they couldn't come up with enough votes to get this thing passed, and it's just waiting there to be passed at some point in the future. And the requirement of the bill is that the CBO and the GAO and the OMB, these are the three big government agencies that calculate the deficit and the debt, that they actually start doing meaningful deficit accounting, which is fiscal gap analysis. And our fiscal gap is going up by the tune of about $6 trillion a year, so that's our true deficit. The official deficit is much smaller because, again, we're keeping so much off the books. I know you folks are focused on gold and whether it makes sense to hold gold. The reality is that there is a good reason to do that, to make sure you're safe, because the country's going broke. And I don't see any politician who's coming forward to really explain the magnitude of our indebtedness.
You actually triggered a memory. If I recall correctly, you penned in a tome back in 2005, the coming, I want to say, generational storm. If memory serves, I mean, you really tied in here an important key concept. And you've been warning, obviously, now for over a decade, this government profligacy, it ends poorly, and we will not have the demographic base to sustain this growing, you might say, discrepancy between retirees, because the retiree base is living longer and longer. You brought up in the past your mom, who evidently, I think, is approaching 98. Or maybe 98 by now after reading the article. She's in solid health, and that's, of course, a wonderful gift. Nevertheless, you know, the younger generations are being forced by our policymakers to pay for this, and you just don't think that's sustainable. Please tell us more.
We have to do a policy reform that is that's the equivalent of either raising taxes by 53% immediately and permanently. Every single federal tax rate has to go up by that amount, or cut spending by 33%, or some combination of tax hikes and spending cuts to eliminate the fiscal gap. So the longer we wait to deal with this problem, the bigger the burden that will be left for our kids. If we wait for 20 years to address this problem, then the tax hike won't be 53%, it'll be more like 65%. At some point, our kids will, you know, if we start rate, we're going to have to print, you know, the politicians will likely try and resort to printing money. That's likely to lead to very high inflation. They're likely to try and nickel and dime us as they've been doing in different ways in a very complex tax code to make us unaware of the fact that we're paying so much in taxes. But it still won't be enough because the problem is so big. We've seen this movie in Argentina, in other countries. You know, Russia has at times run hyperinflation where they couldn't pay their bills. They've had to default on their official debt. At some point, things go very badly, and we could see our kids leave the country because they can't make a living here, or they can make a living, but then the taxes are so high that they've got nothing left to live on. Uruguay, there was a mass exodus of almost 500,000 people from that small country because the tax rates were so high because the country was so indebted. So we have to put everything on the books. We have to be honest with ourselves and with our children where we stand. We have to adopt policies that are actually going to eliminate the fiscal gap. And the easiest way to do this is to eliminate the growth of spending, especially in the healthcare area. where the CBO is projecting significant ongoing increases in Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare expenditures. So I have a book on my website, which is kotlikoff.net, which it's called You're Hired! So You're Hired! A Trump Playbook for Fixing America's Economy. So I wrote this 100-page book after the election, hoping that somebody in the Trump administration would actually pick it up and follow it and take the plans there to fix health care, to fix Social Security, to fix the tax system, to fix the banking system, to fix the education system. But so far I've heard from nobody in the Trump administration that they've even looked at it. I'm not seeing policies that are actually going to address this fiscal gap. It looks like the tax, you know, at best the tax reform will be revenue neutral, and the healthcare reform will likely not get passed, which means that we won't really get everybody covered under some sensible basic healthcare plan and get a lid on federal spending. What we're getting is, under the current status quo, is more and more spending by the federal government in total, and it's directed towards a small segment of society, a relatively small segment. That's not working for the whole population, or certainly not working for our kids. I've been working on this issue since grad school, I graduated in 1977, 40 years ago. So it's been four decades that I've been studying our fiscal imbalance, and every year it's gotten worse.
I don't know if this really ties in perfectly or not, but read an article this morning noting that the world's wealthiest individual, Warren Buffett, recently announced that he has liquidated 100% of his U.S. equities positions, that he's entirely in cash, $80 billion in his piggy bank. He seems to share your sentiments that perhaps the markets have gotten away from themselves and that there just isn't the rosy economic outlook. It's just maybe not sustainable. You've also talked about how long-term treasuries could suffer substantially against this backdrop of government printing. Eventually, that's just a terrible scenario for our banks, which are carrying, you know, the major money lending banks, money center banks, have over $250 trillion in derivatives. Any comments there?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think Warren Buffett's right. I took all my money out of the stock market in February, and I wrote publicly. I read a syndicated column that shows up in like the Dallas Morning News and the Austin Statesman and the Seattle Times and some other papers around the country once a week. And I wrote in my very first column back in February, I said, get out of the market, because the price earnings ratio are pretty much at an all time high. Not an all-time high, but a very high historic level. And Trump's, you know, there's nothing in the Trump plan in what he's proposing that would justify a big run-up in the stock market post-election, which we've seen. There's this underlying fiscal sort of Damocles that's hanging over our economy, which nobody seems to recognize. Yeah, I think Warren is exactly right that the traders down on Wall Street are just trading on what other people that is inducing them to, well, I think everybody else is buying, so I'll buy. So that's just a prescription for a major crash in the market, and that's really what I foresee. So that's why I told everybody in my column to get out, and I took a lot of flack for that. And the market's basically been kind of flat since I said that. It's been down, now it's back up a bit. Position, I don't see the basis for it to be where it is. And yeah, printing money will lead to long-term bonds dropping in value, and that's going to, if the banks are holding long-term bonds as part of their portfolio of assets, they'll suffer major capital losses. Insolvent again, we can have a repeat of the 2008 banking crisis. The assets that the banks held became kind of hot potatoes. Nobody wanted to buy them, and they dropped in value. And then when they do that, they get marked to market. Now the banks are, you know, kind of technically insolvent. They don't have enough capital to cover their liabilities. So, or enough assets to cover their liabilities. And that's why you had so much government nationalization of an intervention in the banking system.
The St. Louis Fed's Fred website, you're right, the balance sheet stagnant there at last check around $4 to $5 trillion, although there's been a lot of rhetoric from policymakers that we might see, at least the FOMC meeting minutes, that we could see pullback in that Fed sheet. There just doesn't seem to be any evidence of it. They don't seem to have the wiggle room to reduce toxic debt from the balance sheet.
Yeah, I mean, if they start selling these assets back into the market, these bonds of different types, that's going to drop bond prices and raise interest rates. And that's going to do exactly what I just said, which is if banks are holding bonds, if bond prices in general are falling, then those bonds that the banks hold as assets on that side of their balance sheet will go down in value, and then their assets will be small relative to their liabilities, and their equity makes up the difference. It's the thing that gives. And if that equity goes to zero or below zero, it becomes a situation of bankruptcy. So, yeah, we don't have a financial system that's any different fundamentally, despite Dodd-Frank, than we had before the 2008 crisis. We haven't dealt with the two major problems in banking, which are leverage and lack of transparency. There's somewhat less leverage. There's no extra additional transparency, and the stress test that experiments that are being run, I think, are basically a sham, because in the context of a major financial panic, assets are going to drop in value beyond what the stress test shows. And if you looked at Lehman Brothers about 3 days before they declared bankruptcy, they were reporting a pretty high capital ratio, and the SEC must have approved their statement that they had a pretty high capital ratio, something like 11%. Well, I don't think any bank in the country today, any major bank, has that much capital. So if Lehman Brothers was actually telling the truth, then what happened was that nobody either believed Lehman Brothers, believed their books, or believed anybody else would believe them and was going to actually invest with them. So they all pulled, went and engaged in a run on Lehman Brothers. They either didn't hand Lehman Brothers any money, didn't lend them any money, or they just asked for their money back. And then Lehman Brothers ran short of cash and had to declare bankruptcy. It's kind of knife edge. If you mix a dollar of payments to somebody, a depositor or a brokerage account where you owe money and somebody wants the money back, you're out of business. And that's exactly what happened. So we need to fix banking from the ground up. And that's not happening in this Trump administration. They want to have Dodd-Frank go away and go back to business as usual. House Financial Services Committee, if you go and look at the membership of the House Financial Services Committee, the chairman, the ranking members of that committee, and then you look at the donors, you'll find J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, other Citigroup, Bank of America. The major financial companies are bribing the people running, the members of Congress on the House Financial Services Committee, and they're now bribing them to through campaign contributions, and they're bribing them to get rid of Dodd-Frank, and that's what is on President Trump's agenda. I'm not a fan of Dodd-Frank. I think it's a lousy piece of legislation. I'd like to see it repealed, but what they have in mind doing is not pushing us towards more opacity, more disclosure, and more equity in the system, but towards the good old days where the entire system could, you know, where there's very little federal oversight and the entire system can go down more or less overnight. There's plenty of room to be concerned. You know, fortunately, the economy seems to be doing pretty well right now, and that's hopeful. But and I hope I'm just dead wrong on everything that I see. I've certainly been predicting major problems from this fiscal gap for a long time, and we haven't seen anything yet happen. So I have some egg on my face from what I've been saying. But when you have 19 Nobel Prize winners endorse the Inform Act, and you have thousands of top economists from around the country endorse the Inform Act, and you have George Shultz, the former Secretary of Treasury and State, endorse the Inform Act, a major former heads of the Council of Economic Advisors and for endorsing the Inform Act, and the list goes on, OMB directors endorsing the Inform Act, then what you've got is the entire economic community of grown-ups saying, this is how we should do the analysis. And when you do the analysis that way, you find we're in very deep debt. I'm not the only one who believes this. I think I'm now got the entire economics profession with me in this concern because they've all signed up. Just go to theinformact.org. You'll see 19 Nobel Prize winners have endorsed the bill. That's something unheard of. We've never seen 19 economists who won the Nobel Prize endorse any piece of legislation. It's very, very, very rare for this to happen. Basically unheard of. That tells you a lot that we economists see collectively a big problem with the U.S. Government's finances.
Well, Professor, I think your efforts are laudable, and certainly there's no need to apologize by simply being way ahead of the curve. It reminds me of Frank Partnoy's, you might remember his groundbreaking novel there, Fiasco. I mean, he outlined the 2008 crisis a decade almost before working up at Morgan Stanley on Wall Street, and he was selling these financial weapons of mass destruction, and he just said, I can't be part of this anymore, went on, earned his law degree, and I believe now still teaches law out on the West Coast, and I think that's what you've done here so well. Hat tip for that. Any parting comments for our listeners? I'm sure you have some key takeaway points.
I write a lot about these kind of macro issues, but also about micro issues, how households can help themselves financially. I write a syndicated column, and as I mentioned, so if you go to kotlikoff.net, you can see all the columns that I've been writing about tax reform, about healthcare reform, about how to think about longevity risk. You know, some things are more macro, some are more personal. Should you take your retirement account money before you take your Social Security or not? The other way around, how to maximize Social Security benefits. And then you also see links to my company's really powerful personal financial planning software. We just came out with a couple new programs. One is called Analyze My Divorce Settlement. We've got 4,500 people a day. Every day, 4,500 people are getting divorced, and they're doing so without really a clear understanding of how they're being treated in the settlement. So this software, which only costs $99, can help you figure out, are you getting a fair deal? What's your living standard going to be like compared to your spouse's living standard once you're divorced? And so it can help you come up with a fair settlement, either on your own or with your spouse. You can propose something that you feel is fair, and know for sure how you're being treated, and avoid all these bills to the lawyers and all the huge wars that occur around divorce. Another program we have is called MaxifiPlanner.com. So it's MaxifiPlanner. And this is a program that figures out a basic plan for your future in terms of saving and spending and buying life insurance, but then it figures out how to maximize your plan and get you more lifetime spending power by figuring out what you should do on Social Security, by figuring out how you should deal with your retirement accounts, by figuring out whether or not you should annuitize your retirement accounts when you start taking the money. So it's really powerful. Both of these new tools are online. Both cost $99 for the household and about $3.99 for financial planners to use with households.
Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, we appreciate your thoughts and look forward to talking to you again.
My pleasure, and thanks again for having me.